Bob, I have your attention, thank you very much. I'd like to introduce Professor Joseph Camilleri from Dr. University in Serbia. He's from the Institute of International Studies, a specialist in Asian affairs, and we'll be talking to you already from what we advertised on the rights of China. So I'll leave the floor to you.
Thank you very much. Thank you, Professor Pirone. It's a pleasure to be here and to be visiting this lovely university, and of course to have the opportunity to share with you a few thoughts about this very interesting and certainly important subject, which is the future role of China. Well, not just the future role of China, I should hasten to add, but of course the present and the recent role of China as well. I think it's fair to say that China is now occupying already a major place in international affairs. It has grown dramatically in the last 20 or so years, and all the indications are that it will continue to do so in the years ahead. So what I propose to do over the next 45 minutes or so, and then perhaps a few minutes for questions at the end, is to give you some idea of how I see China having travelled over the last 20 years in particular, but with a little bit more historical perspective as well, and perhaps beginning to address a few of the key questions that are going to be central to the role that China is and will continue to play over the next 10 years and beyond. Of course, we know that China is not really a country. Yes, in a formal sense, China is a state, just like France is a state, Australia, the United States, Malta, and many others. In that sense, it's just one state, like the 190 or so states that are members of the United Nations. But in fact, China is so much more. China is a civilization. China is a world of its own. And it's only because of events primarily over the last 100 or so years, a little longer, 150 years, where China did decline politically, strategically, economically, and in some sense, perhaps even culturally, although that's a more complex question. It's because of that that for many in Europe, in the West more generally, that China has not been center stage. But we're beginning to accustom ourselves to the idea that China is now going to be center stage. China has been rising steadily, especially over the last 20 years, but you could say with historical perspective, hindsight, that it's been rising ever since the conclusion of the Second World War and the coming to power of the Chinese Communist Party in October 1949. There are a few words which every Chinese merchant, and there are 1.3 billion Chinese today. And that's just China. I'll talk about that in a moment. There are a few words which just about every Chinese person, adult certainly, knows. And they are the words which were uttered by Chairman Mao Zedong immediately after the communist victory of October 1949, when he addressed the Chinese population. In the English translation, it's just four words. And the words are, China has stood up. And everything that's been done by Chinese governments, in spite of all the ups and downs, and there have been many of these over the last 15, 54 years, that idea has been central to every government and to every major policy. That China has stood up, and the humiliation which it believes it experienced at the hands of primarily Western powers. Britain, France, Germany, Russia, and of course most recently the United States. That experience would somehow be rectified. And much of what has been done by Chinese governments are very different, with very different approaches. If we think of the leadership of Mao Zedong, followed by Deng Xiaoping, and most recently Jiang Zemin, quite different approaches in many respects. And yet, that has been a constant theme. That the time has come for China to reassert itself, to rediscover its historical importance, certainly in Asia and beyond that, because we are living in a globalized world internationally. Let me, just before I describe some of the more recent developments, remind you of the main phases that China's external relations have gone through since 1949. And they're quite remarkable stages, because they are the result of conscious policy. Usually conscious policy pursued over a period of a decade, in some cases two decades. Conscious policy. There are very few governments in the world that pursue policies with a lead time of 10 to 20 or 30 years. But that, by and large, has been the Chinese approach, certainly since the period of communist rule. In the initial period, I'll do this very, very quickly because I think it's very important context. In the initial period, of course, China made the decision, 49 onwards, that it would lean, that was the actual word used, that it would lean on the Soviet Union. China was a communist power, and it saw the Soviet Union as its primary supporter. Though it's very important to remember that China never accepted Soviet hegemonic leadership and regarded itself, ideologically at least, as the equal of the Soviet Union. Indeed, Mao probably regarded himself as superior, certainly superior to Stalin, and superior certainly to any of Stalin's successors, Khrushchev onwards, regarded himself as ideologically superior in terms of stating what are the principal tenets and implications of socialist doctrine or socialist ideology. But nevertheless, there was a conscious decision to lean on the Soviet Union for technological reasons, for political reasons, for strategic reasons. So this first period was one of alignment with the Soviet Union and hostility towards the United States. An ambiguous hostility to States, a period of very tense relationship between Beijing and Washington. However, by the late 50s, China was experiencing increasing difficulties in its relationship with Moscow over many fronts, but most importantly on the strategic front, and within that area, most sharply in relation to what it perceived to be the Soviet Union's refusal to share its nuclear technology, particularly nuclear weapons technology, with China. In other words, the Soviet Union's refusal to assist China to develop its own nuclear weapons. There were many other bones of contention. I don't have time to deal with them here, but that they were central. And by the late 50s, the relationship between the Soviet Union and China was souring. And by the early 60s, there was a complete break in relations between China and the Soviet Union. So at that time, let's say early 60s, at the highest level, the Chinese Communist leadership made a decision. That, and this is quite an extraordinary decision, that, and I know of no country, there is no other country that could have made such a decision, would even have contemplated making such a decision. Was that he would pursue a policy of simultaneous hostility towards both Moscow and Washington. Not just neutral, but simultaneous hostility towards both. And that policy basically lasted for 10 years as well, from the late 60s to the early 70s. And the break in that came, of course, with the thaw in relations between China and the United States, which culminated in the dramatic visit of Nixon to Beijing. When Kissinger, in a secret visit to Beijing a year or 18 months beforehand, had discussions with the Chinese leadership, it became very clear that it was the United States that would send its leader to Beijing. And it would have to be done on China's terms. The outstanding issue between the two being then, as to some extent it remains even now, the question of the future of Taiwan. And the Chinese leadership made it absolutely clear to Kissinger that if there were to be an improvement in relations between China and the Soviet Union, the United States would have to backtrack, would have to accept the fundamentals of the Chinese position, and it would have to do so on paper. And if Nixon were to visit to Beijing, it would be most welcome to do so, he would have to sign a piece of paper on the dotted line that would accept that there was only one China, that Taiwan was part of China, that there would never be any two Chinas, and that the United States would recognize only one China. That has come to be known as the famous Shanghai Communique of 1972. This is now nearly 30 years. Oh, sorry, it's more than 30 years, 32 years. And of course, every leadership in China, every government since then, has used that piece of paper, the famous Shanghai Communique of 1972, in order to really push at the advantage that it gained diplomatically by what was a coup by its standards. This was an interesting period then that began in the early 70s, in which there was an improvement of relations between China and the United States, culminating with normalization of relations between the two countries in 1978, 78-79, and continuing hostility towards the Soviet Union. So there's a third phase, moving away from simultaneous hostility towards both superpowers, now concentrating hostility towards the Soviet Union, but improved relations with the United States. And then we've entered the fourth phase. I'm running through this very, very quickly, because I really want to come to the more recent period. And then we have the fourth phase, which is the improvement of relations between China and the Soviet Union during the Gorbachev period, with a number of outstanding problems in the Sino-Soviet relationships pretty well resolved during the mid-80s. So by the mid to late 80s, we have come full circle and have entered a new phase, which is reasonable, normal relationships with both, as they were then, superpowers, right at the end of the Cold War, both the United States and the Soviet Union, and now, of course, Russia. And that we are still in that phase. That is to say, a phase in which China is able to have reasonable, normal relations with both of these major powers. And this has lasted for 20 years. This is now the longest phase in China's foreign policy, which is one of a working, relatively constructive relationship with both centers of power. Of course, the former Soviet Union, now Russia, only a shadow of its former self. But for China, still a very important relationship. This period of roughly the last 20 years plus, getting closer to 25 years, is however significant in another way. The two are connected. And this is the decision that was made at the end of the Maoist period, but probably was made even before Mao's death, but certainly became much more forcefully articulated after he had departed. And the period that we associate with Deng Xiaoping, which is the period of modernization. And what we've seen during this period, and by and large, is still with that set of policies, which he enunciated fairly clearly by the early 80s. And that is that China's primary goal, internationally, as well as domestic, would be modernization. The modernization of China's economy, but also, of course, the modernization, as time went on, of its society, of its politics, and of its armed forces. But those other three subordinate to, secondary to, the modernization of China's economy. And for that purpose, certain things would be necessary. One, dependence on Western capital, dependence on Western technology, and of course trade with the Western world. Trade, technology, investment became critical elements of China's modernization policy, of the opening up of the Chinese economy, and of the change from what had been a centrally planned economy to increasingly a market economy. A market economy, to use the formal language that was used then, still used to some extent now, a market economy with socialist characteristics. And this has been an extraordinary period by any historical standard. In fact, there is no comparable performance. For close to 24 years now, China, on an annual basis, has had its gross national product increase year in, year out, between 7% and 13.5% annually. The annual increase of its GNP has been at that level for 24 years without that. That has made the Chinese economy one of the world's major economies. Of course, the Chinese economy is still only a fraction the size of the American economy, and still remains smaller size, quite a bit smaller, than the Japanese economy. However, trade is a much more important part of Chinese economic activity than it is for the United States, or for that matter, Japan. So then, there has been an even faster increase of China's trade on a global scale, averaged out 15 to 20% a year, every year, for more than 20 years. And there is no break in sight to this pattern. This is quite extraordinary. So you have a number of economies around the world, including regional economies, which have become increasingly dependent on the increase in China's trade. In other words, their exports are dependent on breaking through into the Chinese market. All kinds of exports, but particularly manufactured goods of various kinds. This is true as, let's say, my own country, Australia, as it is for many others. Now, the official position, the way it is articulated, is to say that China wants to subordinate, put its foreign policy objectives, make them subordinate to its economic objectives. Everything that is done must be done to promote this economic objective, which is to make the Chinese economy a major economy of global proportions, and to use that as a platform to improve, of course, the economic living conditions of a large proportion of the Chinese population. And you could say that there is a political agenda behind this. Of course, it is important as an objective in its own right, but there is a political agenda. Put it very crudely, the Chinese Communist Party has been in power now without interruption since 1949, despite all the ups and downs and the turbulent years at different times in over this 55-year period. One of its most important, perhaps its most important objective, is to remain in power.
do. Dosha means, in contrast to the Maoist approach, was that it would do it by delivering economic prosperity for a large proportion of the Chinese population. It was he who coined the famous phrase, it is not a crime to get rich. It's very interesting. The phrase to use in the context of Mao's politics. Inconceivable that Mao would ever have coined such a phrase. It is not a crime to become rich. In other words, Deng Xiaoping's strategy, political strategy, was to solidify the political fortunes of the Chinese Communist Party by making it the primary architect of China's new economic prosperity. And the view that is that you will find shared across many in the Chinese Communist Party. Remember, the Chinese Communist Party has a membership in excess of 50 million. It still permeates every layer of Chinese society, every university. A digression, but I think it's useful to keep in mind. Every university, I'm just using that as an example because we are a university. At every level, university, faculty, departmental, is mirrored by a party structure. At every level of organization in China, every level, in every conceivable context, there is a party presence in excess of 50 million. We mustn't underestimate the importance of this party structure and the very significant influence it exerts over Chinese politics, economy, and society. In other words, to make the Communist Party seem to a significant cross-section of the Chinese population as indispensable to the goal of increased economic prosperity. And in order for this to happen, there was the need, still is the need, to develop very close economic relations with much of the Western world, the three sections of the Western world, the United States, Europe, and of course China. Now, of course, it is true that in spite of that decision, strategic decision to move in this direction, and to normalize relations with the entire Western world, and to become an effective member of the United Nations and a great number of other organizations, including, of course, since 1994, the World Trade Organization, since the late 1990s of the World Trade Organization. The fact remains that there are a number of outstanding conflicts or problems that are unresolved, and we can name numbers, several of them. Of course, the Korean conflict and China's possible role in relation to tensions in the Korean Peninsula. There is the question of China's relations in Southeast Asia. There is the whole question of human rights inside China itself. There are trade tensions in the trade relationship between China and some of its major Western partners. There are unresolved questions between Japan and China over disputed islands, the Yavutai Islands. There are questions between Japan and China in relation to the history that goes back to the Second World War and the invasion by the Japanese of China, and in the Chinese view, the failure of the Japanese to properly acknowledge their responsibility and their guilt in those events, and much else, the writing of history books, the visits by prime ministers and other senior Japanese officials of shrines, commemorating the war dead, amongst which are included those who are seen by the Chinese as the perpetrators of the most grotesque atrocities and so on. And this is a question that's currently souring the relationship between China and Japan. There are all of these questions, and of course there is one more that I've deliberately not mentioned so far, the unresolved question of Taiwan. The Chinese, of course, have never deviated from the position that Taiwan is part of China. And they continue to see the failure of Taiwan to become part of China as being primarily the result of American policy. What is it that prevents China taking Taiwan under its umbrella? It is the military capacity of the United States, and in particular, its military support for Taiwan. So that remains a major bone of contention between the United States and China, and of course a bone of contention between the Taiwanese government, particularly the government that has been in office under the present democratic, the shift from the nationalist to the Democratic Party in Taiwan over the last term. Five or so years. Now, I just want to, because these are very complex and very large questions, and we can't, in the short time we have, go into them in any detail, I want to share with you what I believe to be the essence of China's approach, China's current approach to most of these questions. It goes under the label, which is official, another bit of official vocabulary, official language that's used, China's peaceful rise. That's the formal phrase that's used right across China. China's peaceful rise as a major power. How does this happen? It is happening, we know, economically, I believe it's described as in general terms. How can we describe the thinking that is shared by leading officials, policymakers, experts, and a number of intellectuals as to what the strategy that will deliver China's peaceful rise from their point of view? I would say, I would use this metaphor to describe it, that what China is in the process of doing is surrounding anyone who is potentially an enemy of China or hostile to China's ambition to rise peacefully as a major power, surrounding it with a metaphorical net. Layers and layers of netting. Every moment, it will pull, tighten the net. And anyone who is inside, if they resist, will expect to be better. Let me explain this, and this is not meant to suggest that there's some diabolical scheming that's going on. It is a metaphor to explain the situation. Let me illustrate it in a very small way, very quickly, and then perhaps in a more substantive way over the question of Taiwan. And let's take my country, which is Australia. Australia is a very close, particularly under the present government, Australian government, a very close ally of the United States. No matter what the American policies on any major issue, the Australian government is supported. But nevertheless, there is an extraordinary growth in the economic relationship, particularly the trade relationship, between Australia and China. And China has said nothing, not a word, about the Australian government's extraordinary alignment with US policies on every major issue. It just keeps the economic relationship rolling on, to the point that China is now Australia's second major partner, after the United States, second trade partner. And at his, on the occasion of his most recent visit to Beijing, the Australian Foreign Minister, very, very proud of him, made a statement that were there to be conflict in, involving the use of force between Taiwan and China, Australia would not see it as appropriate to its policies or interest to sign in any way with Taiwan or to support the United States. That's quite an extraordinary development. And the reason is pretty simple. A few weeks after that statement was to be made, there were major contracts to be signed between China and Australia for 25-year contracts regarding gas and a number of other major resources. That's how China is engaging with many of its regional neighbours and with a number of other countries. It simply allows its extraordinary economic advance to gradually commit a number of these countries, not necessarily to pro-Chinese positions, but to positions that would not directly endanger China's interests. And we ought to, let me now explain this to you in relation to the most complex question, which is precisely that of Taiwan. There's a lot of nonsense talked about this question in English language publications. People who want to know better, but unfortunately they don't. And operating in the English language can at times be a serious liability. At times. And this is one of them. There is the view that you will often find in English language, particularly American publications, which put across this perspective or analysis, which goes something like this. Taiwan is in the process of democratizing. There is increasingly in Taiwan a mood amongst a significant cross-section of the Taiwanese population for eternal identity, perhaps eventually for independence. And in that sense, time is not on China's side, time is on Taiwan's side. And it's quite wrong. I think I can state it boldly, which I'm usually not tempted to do in an academic context. Why is that so? The economics of the situation are twofold. That the primary source of Taiwanese investment, the primary destination of Taiwanese investment is now China, by long margin. And we have reached the point where China accounts for 1/4 of Taiwan's trade. Now that may not shift the position of the present Taiwanese government into necessarily adopting a much more accommodating position in relation to the future of Taiwan, so far as relations with Beijing are concerned. But it is impacting on a key and very influential sector in Taiwan, which is big business in Taiwan. In today's world, is China's closest ally on the question of Taiwan, the Taiwanese business sector. And who funds, in the long run, China's major political parties? Taiwan's business sector. It's all been worked out by the Chinese policy. They're not going to do anything dramatic. They're not going to launch a war against Taiwan. They might make some threatening noises. They might carry out missile tests, right, very close to Taiwan shore. They might do all of those things. Raise tensions. But they're not going to do anything so foolish as to actually attack Taiwan Russia. All they've got to do is just sit back and wait for the cards to fall as they wish them to fall. The problem, the fact of the matter is that Taiwan's economy now is more and more integrated with China's economy. And within 10 years, would be more integrated with China's economy than the economies of any two European countries inside the European Union. Just think about it. Time is not your side. Provided you think in long term. You're not thinking for tomorrow or the next day. And you know, it's not just that it works that way with Taiwan. It works also in the same way even with the United States. Of course, you may have an American administration. It might be the Clinton administration, it might be the President Bush administration, which at different times feels the need to offer Taiwan some kind of reassurance. And that's not going to change. Future American administrations will want to offer Taiwan some kind of reassurance. But there are key American businesses, some of the largest corporations, that now depend critically for survival on the Chinese market. Let me give you one example. Boeing. There are two major firms in the world that compete for the bulk of the world's commercial civil aviation market. Boeing and Airbus. It's quite possible that one of them will go down. To be sure that you will not go down, you need to have very substantial access to the Chinese market. If you look at the figures, that's how it comes out. Because China is going to have, already has, but it's going to have more and more, a phenomenal civil aviation industry, which can in time produce the planes itself at this stage. Anyhow, it will continue for some considerable time to depend on imports. Of course, it imports both Airbus and Boeing, to the extent it wouldn't put all its eggs in the one basket, and will play the game brilliantly. Let me just give you another illustration. And then take 1 minute, but I think it's interesting. Just over a year ago, perhaps about a year ago, the Chinese president was visiting France. And at the end of that visit, towards the end of that visit, the two presidents held a press conference, attended by a huge media gathering. And of course, everyone wanted to ask the same question about Taiwan. The Chinese president just evaded the question and just sat down and said a simple couple of sentences which came out. He left it deliberately to the French president to answer the question what are his reactions or his government's reactions on the problem of Taiwan. And he didn't hesitate. But it's chance. Of course, it had been rehearsed. These things are not left to chance. He said, "I'm thoroughly displeased with the government of Taiwan because its policies are contrary to peace. I am so displeased that I've asked the Chinese Foreign Ministry to leave the Taiwan file on my desk permanently. I'm going to be looking at it very, very closely. And I'm going to be discussing this very, very closely with Germany and our closest collaborators inside the European Union. It is time for Taiwan to change direction." 2 weeks later, a major contract with the US. This is, we have to understand what's going on, and that is that gradually China is establishing itself as a very significant economic power, even though the size of its economy remains small, although growing very fast in relation to the world's three largest economies, but rising fast. And that has enormous political, diplomatic, and in the longer run, strategic implications. The final thing I want to say in relation to China is another dramatic change that has occurred literally in the last 10 to 15 years. Communist China of the previous 40 years, one of its key characteristics was its refusal, not to say outright hostility, but its refusal to play an active role in international organizations, both globally except of course for the United Nations, where it always wanted to occupy the seat because it had established the one China policy in South the United Nations. But regionally, very suspicious of all existing organizations because it saw them primarily as being platforms for the exercise of Western influence. In a few instances, Russian influence, but primarily Western influence. And didn't want to have anything to do. Over the last 10 years, particularly over the last 10, we've had a dramatic shift, where China has played an increasingly active role in most of Asia's regional organizations, and is now playing a leadership role. It used the 1997 East Asian financial crisis as a moment in order to establish its credentials, even more forcefully than before, as a good regional neighbor. And so over the last, to be precise, since 1997, 7 years, we have had the development of something that's called ASEAN plus three. ASEAN, the Association of Southeast Asian Nations, made up of the 10 countries that form Southeast Asia, which has been the leading regional organization in East Asia. And now we have ASEAN plus three, which is ASEAN plus China plus Japan plus South Korea. And it's clear as we look at the record of the last 7 years, and these ASEAN plus three is now meeting at the summit level, prime minister or president, every year since 1997. And developing not just a common economic program, but increasingly a political program. It's clear that China has now acquired leadership role inside ASEAN plus three, shared to some extent with ASEAN, the regional organization, with Japan, if anything, at the fringe. Japan's president, fully participates, but certainly not able at this point to exercise that. And what's true of ASEAN and ASEAN plus three is also evident in the six-party talks of three. Who did the United States ask to chair the six-party talks with a view to some hopeful resolution of the Korean problem? China. Because China has special connections, of course, with North Korea, a reasonable relationship with the United States and all the other parties. China is the one that chairs the six-party talks. Similarly, in relation to a number of disputes about disputed islands in Southeast Asia, China has taken a leading role in developing the Code of Conduct, which goes somewhere, early days, admittedly, towards resolving what would be a very serious conflict in the region, six countries claiming a small group of islands known as the Spratly Islands. China claims sovereignty over the whole lot of things. But there are many, many others, other examples, including, of course, its role inside the United Nations, increasingly its role in the WTO, and interestingly enough, even on human rights questions. Now, we know, of course, that human rights performance inside China remains very defective. China is aware, the Chinese leadership is aware, the intellectual leadership is aware that this is a big issue on the international stage. It's not going to go away. So unlike the, let's say, the reaction or the response of what might have been previous Chinese administrations, it has been prepared to enter into a dialogue situation with a number of Western countries, including the United States. Not necessarily that it makes major concessions, but at least prepared to enter into the dialogue, and has established in many Chinese universities, human rights institutes, human rights programs, not which actually deliver human rights, but which discuss human rights, which develop expertise around human rights questions. What I'm trying to say is that the Chinese government is increasingly able to play a highly sophisticated role in both regional and global diplomacy, even on the most contentious questions, from its point of view, including the human rights question. Now, all of this is not meant to give you the impression that I think that there are no problems or difficulties facing China in over the next 5-10 years and beyond. There are many problems. I'll just name them because there is no time. One, yes, there's been economic growth, but at a considerable cost. And the cost is sharp economic inequalities between different parts of China, in particular coastal China and inland China. There has been a very serious environmental cost, which sooner or later will need to be addressed as a major national priority. It cannot evade that problem. There is the whole question of the state-owned enterprises of China and the difficulty they pose. They provide at the moment a very useful buffer against greater unemployment. However, they come at very considerable cost. They are much more inefficient than privately owned enterprises in such a nation. There is, of course, the question of Chinese minorities in Tibet, in Xinjiang, and to a lesser extent elsewhere, and these remain points of contention. And there is probably the most difficult, as I said, of all problems, the one that's most elusive and hard to pin down. And that is, assuming that China is able to grow, continue to grow economically, and the expectation must be that it will be able to continue to grow economically. And assuming that China does not implode, meaning break up in some kind of major political upheaval, assuming that that does not happen, probably on balance one would have to say less likely to happen than more likely to happen. There is still the question of how China's culture will negotiate this very unusual state of affairs, which is China become part of a globalizing world. What will be the role of China's culture, of China's civilization? Okay, it may not be a crime to be rich. And is that all there is to life? Being rich? Or richer. How will the present government, the present political regime, negotiate or handle the very difficult business of providing, once again, China with a real soul? What will be the soul of its politics, the soul of its society? What ideas? Okay, you can become technologically more capable, you can become economically more competitive. In order to orient yourself, what does China have to say to the world? These are very difficult questions which political and intellectual elites are only now just beginning to wrestle with. So China is going to be, I think, a very interesting country to follow for many years to come, not just in economic, political, and strategic terms, but in terms of culture. What will be China's cultural contribution to the rest of the world, to the region and the rest of the world, and how will it itself handle the problem of globalization if it's not to be another name for westernization, which it says it does not want? What does China becoming economically competitive with China's characteristics really look like halfway through? The 21st century. These are important questions to which I don't believe anybody has got real answers to, including probably most of China's current policy aims. So stay tuned. There's some very interesting and unfinished and very interesting and fascinating story still to be told. Thank you very much.
I have a question on Taiwan. You just said that China would not, you were just so confidently, you said that China would definitely not attack on Taiwan. And Does that mean unification? Does that mean Taiwan would be, would change its mind, like to integrate itself with China?
Well, that is a very interesting question. And in you framing the question, you compel me rightly to be a little bit more subtle in the way I present the position. I think it's most unlikely, yes, that China will attack by use of force Taiwan. This is not to say it could not possibly happen, never will happen, can't happen. And all kinds of miscalculation are still possible on both sides, which could provoke some kind of conflict. But I don't think it's very likely. So what are the options? From the Chinese side, and you know, this will have to be a negotiated position, but from the Chinese side, they would probably, and Deng Xiaoping said as much, they would probably be willing to accommodate for a considerable period of time, at Taiwan, that remained more or less as it is. Deng Xiaoping is reported to have said that he would be even willing to contemplate the possibility of Taiwan retaining its independent armed forces, so long as Taiwan, in exchange, was willing to accept the principle that the capital of China is Beijing. So there's a lot of possibilities, permutations and combinations that may be possible once a serious discussion gets underway. We haven't started getting to that point in time. But certainly, if ever there were to be some kind of resolution, some kind of accommodation, it would not be a repeat of Hong Kong. It would have to be something quite different. And the question is whether the two sides are able to imaginatively come up with such a solution. And for that, time alone can tell.
We have seen China's diplomatic strength on the international scene, its economic success. I would like to know something about China's position, China's government's position from within China. I mean, all right, they had economic success, but still, as you said, you pinpointed human rights failures, still lots of people live under poverty conditions. Could the Chinese government control the movements rising in China? Could we see a review of what happened in the Soviet Union?
That there could be turmoil in China, of course, that's quite possible. That there could be turmoil in China of the kind that we saw in the Soviet Union in 1989, much less likely. The Chinese have studied the Soviet case very, very closely, and have identified what they see as the major weaknesses that led to Soviet decline, and more than decline, breakup. It doesn't mean, of course, that they have learned all the lessons they need to learn. So please don't think that I feel that I can predict the future. Nevertheless, my inclination, if I'm to hazard a guess, would be that there will be, over the next 10 or 15 years, there already has been, that there will be more of a political opening. Not as dramatic as the economic opening, but there will be a political opening. Now, I mean, I notice even now, I go to a university in China, be it in Beijing or Shanghai, and I can have discussions with Chinese colleagues, the kind that would never have been imagined possible 10 or 15 years earlier, let alone 30 years earlier. So there is an awful lot of opening up going on, an awful lot of debate and discussion that's going on inside China. I will see, over time, the Chinese political system gradually allowing more of this opening up to occur. Now, there will be tensions, and there are tensions inside the Chinese Communist Party as to how fast, how much of it, when, in what circumstances, those debates will take place. But I don't see the likelihood, let's say for the next 10 years, of the Chinese Communist Party being swept from office by some kind of turmoil or some major demonstration of public sentiment. I do not see that happening. If it ever came to that crunch again, the Chinese military step in and kill us. It is primed to do that should it ever come to that point. I don't think it probably will come to that point. There's not going to be a Ukrainian revolution inside China. Forget it.
What exactly is the approach of the Chinese government regarding the state-owned enterprises you mentioned? Just surely a burden on the rising economy, keeping in mind the party's ideology.
Yes. Well, it's a very difficult issue for them, because if they move one way, it's trouble, and if they move another way, it's also trouble. There is in some parts of China considerable unemployment already. There is unemployment. The issue that could one day bring a government down would be massive unemployment. So the Chinese government is very anxious to prevent that from happening. The state-owned enterprises, inefficient though they are, soak up an awful lot of jobs. Probably between 200 and 300 million jobs are still delivered by state-owned services or enterprises. So, yes, you want to make them more efficient, but you're not going to push them to become more inefficient and more efficient at the expense of creating wholesale unemployment. So the question, this is going to be the real test of the capacities of the Chinese government, whether it can, over time, improve the effectiveness of these enterprises and all begin to privatize to some extent some of them, while at the same time retaining a substantial labor force in employment. So that's a major issue, and you find at every annual major meeting of either party or Congress, this issue openly discussed. One of the interesting things about the Chinese administration of the last at least 10 to 15 years, is how they are prepared to discuss economic problems publicly. In fact, when you have the Premier, giving his annual report, the first thing he will do, spend probably at least 15 to 20, 25 minutes of his annual report, is talk about all the major economic problems that China faces, which he says are so serious that they could reach critical proportion if we don't do something about them. And this one is always right at the top of the list. So there is great consciousness that unless this issue is dealt with, but it's very difficult. If you go too fast one way or the other, there's a lot of trouble. So how to negotiate it, and that's what they're trying to do. Will they be successful? How successful? I can't predict it. We'll just have to wait and see.
One final question, because time is pressing. Yes. I read a brief article on some publication about the Chinese leadership's fascination with Western culture. Would you agree that this is true? And if it is true, has it affected China's policy anyway, Nietzsche's policy for the last 2 years?
We need to be careful about this. If you say fascination with Western culture, if you mean the culture of consumption, large shopping complexes, much larger in Shanghai and Beijing now than in most parts of the Western world. Technological device development, gadgetry, use of appliances, all of those things. Yes, there's enormous attraction to have all of those, to consume more of those and so on. But if you mean by culture, moving towards the Western approach to family life, the Western approach to authority. All the people that I know in China are still very closely connected to family connections, which have enormous importance. The role of the elderly in Chinese society still remains very important. The role of authority at various levels still seen as terribly important. There is, in that sense, no great movement towards adopting many of the traits that we associate with contemporary Western culture. So it's a hybrid. it's a two-way, and I think a lot of this is still to be played so well. How precisely China will be able to connect, incorporate many of its older cultural civilization characteristics into the modern, globalizing, technologically more sophisticated China, that's another question that remains to be fully played out. And we can see it very clearly emerging as an issue, even in the structure of China's educational systems, in the way primary and secondary schools are organized, and much else. So, fascinating story, but open-ended. We don't really, or at least I don't know, how it's going to pan out over the next 10, 20, or 30 years.
Well, thank you, Professor Camilleri, for that very interesting and enlightening talk. But before we go away, I'd like to invite Professor Camilleri, who is an expert on Malaysia, to say a few words on the subject. It is a subject which we unfortunately don't have much capacity or even call to deal with in our course in international relations, and I think it's something which it would be quite helpful for most of you to be exposed to. Please help me get exposed to it.
I'll be very, very quick. As you know, you come from Australia, which is a country with a very short European history of about 210 years. Yet, if you look at Australia on the world map, we are surrounded by non-European countries. We are surrounded by Asian countries. There is a real tug of war in Australia between, do we concentrate on our historical links, our links with Europe, and especially links with Britain, or do we look at our geography, so it's history versus geography. And it's, to me, very important that we look at where we are and we say, well, how are we relating? Whether we are linked to Europe or not, we are surrounded by Asian countries. So where should our links be? Surely it makes sense that our links should be with our neighbours. We don't have to sever the other links. So I did a study of the way we look at one of our neighbours, and I chose Malaysia. Malaysia is a small country. I suppose it's relative, but it's a small country to our north. It's one of the two closest countries to Australia that are Muslim countries. And in today's world, it is very important, I feel, to look at our Muslim neighbours in the current world situation. And I chose to study a very well-read newspaper in Melbourne, The Age, over 15 years, to see how it reported this country, Malaysia. In other words, it, I suppose, to be seen in a larger context, the way the European mind, if you like, in Australia, looks at the other culture, the other. And I documented what The Age newspaper, which is a middle class paper, so it's read by people who really contribute to public opinion, as well as their ideas are also formed by what they read in the paper, so it's a two-way thing. So I just put this study together, and the Malaysians were quite interested, and they actually published the findings, and I'll be very pleased to present this book.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. As the results of what I found about the way the Australian press depicted this relationship.